Hello, and welcome to part two of BJA's Body-Worn Camera podcast with Mr. Adam Rosenberg from the Boston Children's Abuse Center. In this segment, Mr. Rosenberg discusses policy recommendations regarding body-worn cameras and video retention policies.
If you were advising a police department that was developing a policy for a body-worn camera program, what kind of recommendations or what important advocacy issues would you like to see addressed in that policy?
You know, I think one of the first things I'd want to do is, in advising a department about creating policy for body-worn camera is to include those advocates who are impacted by those issues. So, having some consultations about, look, here's the body-worn camera program, and, this is what we hope it does. How is this going to affect you and your community? And those different communities, I think, for advocates are certainly survivors of homicide, domestic minor sex trafficking, human trafficking, child abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault. Talking to those communities and say, what is it going to mean to you that a camera's rolling or not rolling in these circumstances there? What would you like to see? Part of it is, I was taught by a mentor a long time ago that people support what they help create. And if we have the ability within a local jurisdiction to develop policy in conjunction with the inputs from the local advocacy community, who are the very people that these cameras are aiming to protect, then we'll be more successful there. That policy may and will vary dramatically from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but I think it's based on what that jurisdiction's tenor and interests are to be able to most effectively have that policy there. Good bodies to be able to speak to, are finding one's local children's advocacy center. If one doesn't know how to find their local CAC, it's going to the National Children's Alliance website, nationalchildrensalliance.org, and, being able to find out what their local center is. So that local center can begin to weigh in on, well, what does it matter for us about kids on video? And doing the same thing with the other, communities there, domestic violence and sexual assault. I think survivors of homicide as well. I think it's a real graphic image to have, that homicide victim, on the ground, and it would be a very bloody, awful scene. It's the prosecutor in me says it's great footage to show to a jury. But the humanitarian, I guess, for lack of any better term, and it's not that one's the opposite of the prosecutor, but that's a gruesome, grisly scene, right? I mean, how do we balance that? How do we have a sensitive approach to these things there? That, at some point, if there's a body there, does someone say to an officer, turn that thing off? Right. Is it really any different than the media coming and with a camera on the scene there? At some point, we want to be able to grieve in private. Part of the guidelines in creating with community is, and maybe it's even talking with local media, sort of what are their guidelines as to when they film and when they don't film? And, is 5 seconds of footage enough? Or, does one need to leave these things on for a while? Right. And by the way, there's still officer safety there. So there's an element of, we're going to leave these cameras on, but we're not going to be staring at the body so that, an officer's not doing that. It's a tremendous amount of footage that I think, has great potential but also great risk there. That'd probably be the first thing I'd want to be able to develop, is that there should be how the policy impacts children and victims. Is there a second, and then as we develop policy further, is there a different body-worn camera policy for the detective units than there is for the patrol units? Right. Certainly, they'll have different interactions with families there, but certainly the need to protect and preserve detectives is just as great. At the same time, though, they have a very specific different mission in mind when they're going out and having those interviews there.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot to consider when developing a policy, and another really important thing to consider is record retention. So I'm curious to hear how long your agency retains that video footage that you capture, and what decisions went into that retention policy.
Children's advocacy centers are, they vary somewhat from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Some are law enforcement operated, some are, child welfare operated, under their Child Protective Services. some are prosecutorial, and then some are, like us, you know, independent nonprofit organizations. We made the decision a long time ago that, you know, at this point, we're just keeping all the video. I mean, the video storage is small enough that, you know, it's just sitting on a hard drive, and that's where it is. So it's not taking up, you know, rooms and rooms of you know, file rooms. The advantage of the digital age is that, you know, its storage is smaller. The disadvantage, of course, is that, we have the propensity exists not to get rid of anything. But we've decided to keep it for a couple of reasons. I think reason number one is that these are cases that sometimes take years to come to fruition, and there are certainly children who have made statements at younger ages at a time when the case wasn't necessarily able to go forward that, you know, may be able to do something with it at a later age. There are also children who come forward multiple times and that you're able to begin to develop patterns over time there with that. There probably will come a time when we say enough is enough. I mean, we've been recording now for, I think, 6 years. And so maybe we do have to have a conversation at some point as to how long do we retain this. Probably the biggest question that goes into any retention policy is, frankly, you know, not necessarily, how long one keeps it, but, you know, what is one's capacity in storage? You know, how much is one willing to invest in the long-term storage of this? It's easier for us as a center in an urban setting to be able to say, yeah, we're going to store about 1,000, you know, digital copies of interviews a year. But that's far less digital footage than the terabytes of footage that's going to occur, you know, from the city of Baltimore when they start recording. When you're filming every officer every day, that's a lot of footage there. Like a lot of corporate America's gone, that I think it's worth consulting attorneys to talk about, you know, document retention policies and just coming up with what a policy is in terms of, just having a policy. Are we keeping video for 6 months? Are we keeping video for 2 years? Are we keeping video for 2 weeks? I think part of that policy is, you know, when do you think you're going to want to go back and watch that video? Are we only using video for the protective interactions between law enforcement and citizens? Or, you know, particularly with these victim cases, is there more that's at play there? And then if we're going to be pulling out portions of body-worn camera video to be able to be used in court, to be able to capture the chaos of crime scenes, then we want to make sure that the retention policy doesn't inadvertently destroy evidence there.
Right. Absolutely. You recently attended BJA's expert panel on body-worn cameras where there were law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, public defenders. What was your biggest takeaway from that event?
I had a couple takeaways from that event, from the BJA event. You know, one takeaway was that, everybody's all over the map, doing many different things. I was amazed to see, the amount of, forwardness that jurisdictions like Seattle, where they're recording everything and they're making everything available, and they went ahead and went full tilt on it. There were certainly other agencies that are still very tenuous about what's being recorded there. I saw that the one of the big takeaways was that ability to create a dialogue and a partnership with your local community. So the communities who did this right were the ones who didn't just show up with body cameras on their uniforms one day, but have spent weeks in preparation meeting with community leaders and community activists talking about how the body-worn camera program is going to work. That was really revelatory to me that, you know, it was more than just, you know, how are we storing this stuff. I think the storage actually was a bit of a surprise, too, that you just start thinking about how much data is being generated there, that you've got to figure that out, the storage, the maintenance of it, the charging of this equipment. I mean, it's a lot of technical assistance and manpower to be able to make this happen. And, you know, it costs a heck of a lot more than just someone buying $75,000 worth of body cameras. I mean, you really got to spend a lot of time maintaining, replacing, and assisting that stuff. That was a surprise to me. I think, you know, there's the real scope and extent of the program, the number of jurisdictions that are already doing this and doing this in a wide variety of ways. And I guess what didn't surprise me, which is probably why I and some other people were invited to it, was we haven't even figured out what we're doing with this video in terms of victims and with how do we use this video as collateral evidence. Again, the prosecutor in me, even the child advocate in me, would hate that this video is off limits in those cases, because it shows things that just aren't always testified to. Child cases are really hard to prove, you know, even harder than domestic violence and adult rape cases, because there's a general, people don't want to believe kids, and because these incidents occurred at such a different time that it's hard to corroborate the evidence. So, you know, good detectives and multidisciplinary teams are looking for the ways to corroborate that evidence. And I think it would really be special if after a child's forensic interview, we'd be able to go back and review the footage from that house to be able to see, you know, were there things in there that match up with the child's story? Or, you know, if they don't match up with the child's story, you know, it's easier to be able to review the footage and to say that something doesn't line up than to be grilling the kid about, you know, what their memories were there. Does that make sense? In terms
Absolutely.
Of, you know, yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, I think we've just really begun to figure out how can we utilize this footage there. And it would really be, what a shame it would be that, you know, we've got the ability to corroborate what the scene looked like, and we can't use it. We can't show it to the child, or we wouldn't be able to show it to a jury. I think that's important to be able to have that access there. Because you're able to take a kid back to that scene much easier than having them, you know, sort of recall it and explain it to you.
Yes, definitely. It definitely is an important tool. I agree. Very, very interesting. What is the most important advice you would give someone who is considering implementing a body-worn camera program?
You know, I think the most important piece of advice that I'd give someone considering implementation of a program is to take it slow and to consider all the different variables and parameters involved, to not set up false expectations that we're going to go live in, you know, in 2 months, you know, we got the cameras, we're going live, but to really use this as an opportunity to engage the community into how this is going to protect everybody. It's, you know, that ultimately, you know, it's going to reduce false complaints on both sides. Mm-hmm. And that people have an opportunity to see, you know, what footage looks like, so they have an understanding about how this new technology works. And once that's done, then being able to figure out what the impact is of these, you know, of this technology for a variety of situations. I mean, going through different scenarios and seeing that, you know, how does it work in domestic violence? How does it work in arson? How does it work in child abuse? And, you know, and then figuring out from there. I think part of it is the understanding that we're just not going to get it right the first time out of the box. So, you know, that there's maybe a self-stated, you know, 3 month pilot period that we're, instead of rolling cameras out for the entire jurisdiction, you know, let's you know, do different segments to get their feel as to how cameras work and how it impacts their work there.
Absolutely.
I think it's about taking the time, and doing it right. Because it's gonna take some time to be able to get this going there. And it really is not even overthinking the presence of the camera. You know, maybe this is an answer to an earlier question as well, but that we don't want to, we still want detectives to be good detectives, and we want police and patrol to be good patrol officers. And what I mean by that is, you know, we don't want them to essentially become drones that all they're doing is standing there while the suspect, the victim, the witness is talking, and then they didn't take any notes. That we don't want to become so reliant upon the fact of what the, you know, what a person's saying to a camera. I think just as important still is good police work and being able to assess the situation and you know, still take notes and not necessarily just saying to a, you know, a victim, hey, what happened to you? Talking to the camera. That would be a mistake because it would then I think diminish that investigative ability that a good patrol officer or a good detective has. I think the camera needs to be able to sort of meld into the background and still let the detective, you know, do their work or let patrol do their work to assess the situation. And the camera shouldn't be the primary investigator, but should be a good backup tool.
Absolutely. We really have only just begun understanding the implications of the footage that's captured through these cameras. So we are very grateful that you could speak with us today to share your perspective on the side of the juvenile issue. So once again, thank you so much, Mr. Rosenberg. Thank you again.
My pleasure, and best of luck with the implementation of these programs. And we look forward to seeing how they work out.
Absolutely. Thank you again. We encourage law enforcement, justice, and public safety leaders to visit the body-worn camera toolkit at www.bja.gov/bwc. This toolkit offers a variety of resources that agencies can use to help with adoption and use for community engagement, policy development, data collection, officer training, and educational purposes. We also encourage listeners to share and promote these resources with your colleagues and staff. Lastly, all of these resources, especially the body-worn camera toolkit, have been designed as a national resource, your resource. Please submit your ideas for new content through the BWC support link at the bottom of the homepage. This is Lauren Gonzalez of the Bureau of Justice Assistance Body-Worn Camera Team signing off. Thank you to our listeners for joining us today.